From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. This week, we talk with a Hollywood assistant who, like many, has not only been underpaid, but has had staplers and markers, even her own shoe, thrown at her. She came to the studio with former assistant Liz Alper, who created the hashtag PayUpHollywood and who's heard stories like that before.
When you said stapler, in my head, that I kind of went, yeah, that's the number one item that apparently gets thrown at assistants.
We need somebody to design like foam staplers.
Yes, you know? Yes.
Or just not throw them.
Former assistant Liz Alper and current assistant Joelle, first name only, please, share stories from the trenches and explain why assistants feel now is the time to demand change for the sake of the assistants themselves and the future of the industry. But first on the news banter, to binge or not to binge. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we are now, as we have talked about almost ad nauseum, the streaming services coming onto the field of play. But let us talk about the different models that are being tried. Netflix came up with the binge. And I think the binge, when Netflix was by itself in the world, the binge was something that was buzzy and cool and nobody had seen. And it was a phenomenon. Now everybody's getting in the game. Disney Plus, Warner has HBO Max, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are various approaches to figuring out what is the best way to go. Disney Plus, for example, is not going to drop, you know, The Mandalorian, its Star Wars show, is not dropping it all at once. It's dropping it one a week. And the idea for that, obviously, is they do not want people like me, perhaps, or people who are even more avid Star Wars fans, to binge the heck out of it and then say, well, that was cool, and now I don't need to pay $7 a month anymore.
Yeah, this is the strategy. And I think everybody is trying out and experimenting with what might work for them. You see Apple TV Plus, their service, they're trying a mix. Certain things, like The Morning Show, they dropped 3 episodes and then it was weekly. And some of the other series, like this Dickinson, Emily Dickinson show, they dropped all of them at once. And I think that they're trying to figure out what their viewers like while trying to keep people in this ecosystem, because unlike with your cable and satellite provider, where you had to have someone come to the house and you had a big clunky box and, you know, unsubscribing was kind of a hassle, these streaming services, you can turn them on and off with a few clicks of your phone. So they've really got to create this habit where you just have these services part of your life and are accustomed to paying for them. And the way to do that, in this theory, is to keep people waiting for another episode week after week.
Yeah, in case of Warner's HBO Max, for example, Kevin Reilly, the chief creative officer, said, hey, you can watch all the old stuff you want and binge it, but if it's the new stuff, no. Now, interestingly, we had Rich Greenfield, the Wall Street analyst, on our show a few weeks ago, and he was trying to explain why picking and choosing among the streaming services would not bankrupt us after we were so excited about not having to have a bunch of stuff forced on us by a cable bundle. And one of his arguments was, hey, it's so easy to click in and out of these things. You can subscribe and unsubscribe, just as you were saying, Matt, and it's easy. But at the same time, he has offered the opinion that binging is pro-consumer and hard to move away from. So basically, he's saying, binging, you got to do it, guys. You got to give people the opportunity to binge these shows. But by the way, it's so easy to cancel. So consumers, go ahead and do that.
Well, it's easy for Rich Greenfield to say that. He doesn't run an actual media company where you've got to, you know, build your subscriber base quarter after quarter or else your stock tanks. And I think if Disney is going to try to get to some of these lofty subscriber goals, anywhere between 60 million and 90 million in the next 5 years, they've got to amass this big subscriber group. And the way you do that is to keep people interested. So I understand why they're doing this weekly model. But, you know, Netflix has had a lot of success building their own subscriber base with dropping all episodes at once. And when you ask Ted Sarandos, the chief creative officer of Netflix, he says that he gets frustrated with the HBO shows he loves because he wants to watch all the episodes of Succession and he can't. But then you ask HBO and they say, no, no, no. We love the fact that everybody was talking about Succession for 2 months. And it was just a giant media cycle for us where we dominated and got people interested and kept them interested. And you don't get that when you drop all episodes at once.
As a reporter who has access sometimes to a lot of episodes, and Succession is a specific example, you know, HBO gave them to me. And as much as I do enjoy that show, I chose to wait because I wanted to be in the conversation when other people were in the conversation. And I found it just more relaxing to sit down and watch it in its time instead of gobbling them all up. Now, very few people I think would hold off like that. And I was tempted myself, but it is more fun to be that kind of communal experience is really rare now in entertainment. And I think it's just more fun. So I have to disagree with Ted Sarandos about that.
Well, we're seeing it right now with the Star Wars show, The Mandalorian. You know, these episodes are dropping on Friday, and over the weekend, you're seeing this whole conversation online about Baby Yoda and, you know, what's going on with that show. And that is just free advertising for Disney Plus. And I'm sure they had this all planned out when they knew they had this idea for Baby Yoda. That's the biggest ambassador for Disney Plus that they could have.
And of course, you know, for some of these companies, that this is their business. It's maybe less imperative, like Amazon has added on their streaming stuff basically to Amazon Prime. And I would be an Amazon Prime subscriber without Mrs. Maisel. So, you know, but they think that it helps. But if you're Amazon, if you're Apple, it's not so imperative. Meanwhile, you know, I'm just going to touch on the Oscar race. We haven't talked about it at all. And it's been mushy, very, very mushy. And, you know, I feel like people were sort of waiting, like, is this the one? Is this the one? Because often, as we've talked about in years past, there's something that emerges and it just has the mark of destiny. I mean, we knew for months that, for example, going back years, Lord of the Rings, third installment, was almost absolutely sure going to win Best Picture, and it did. This has not been that kind of year. We haven't had that kind of year in recent years, really. I mean, last year with Green Book, my God. But 1917, which is a film that didn't play the festivals and just was dropped by Universal, this is Sam Mendes's film. It's shot to look like one shot. It's World War I. This thing played, and now all of a sudden, everybody's kind of swooning over it.
And when you say they dropped it into the race, it wasn't because this was some strategic move. Sam Mendes said he finished the film 6 days before it premiered in New York this past week. And it really was just a race to get this movie out. And that sometimes happens in the Oscar race. I remember that with The Big Short. I remember that with some of the Clint Eastwood films, where these films open, do the festivals, you know, win Cannes, and all these Oscar movies are positioned. And then something comes along and just becomes the belle of the ball late in the race. And that may be happening this year. But I actually like the fact that this year, like the previous few years, there really is no preordained Best Picture winner. And there are plausibly 5, 6, 7 films that could walk away with it. And that's, at least that's from my perspective as someone who covers this Oscar race pretty closely, it's much more exciting when there isn't a clear front runner.
Yeah, there isn't a preordained winner. I mean, from the Academy's point of view, of course, is what they want is a commercial movie. And Joker is still something that people think could be in contention. There's often a feeling, I know people who deliberately want to keep a movie under the radar and let it open kind of now, late in the year, because they want this feeling that the Academy is discovering something, that it's not just this menu that you've already seen, but look, here's a surprise entree. And that may be, whether Sam Mendes did it on purpose or not, what happens with 1917 is too soon to say.
Yeah, and you know, there are some of these films that Netflix has put in theaters, but will then debut on the service in December. I know Irishman is out over the Thanksgiving weekend, and you know, Marriage Story is coming later in December. And I think there may be a little bit of a sense of discovery for some people who haven't seen those films in theaters. But everything from Jojo Rabbit, which won the Toronto Audience Award, to this South Korean film Parasite, which won the Cannes Film Festival, to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which was a big hit for Quentin Tarantino this summer, and he's an Academy favorite, to even A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, which is the Mr. Rogers film that's getting good notice right now. I mean, there's a lot of these movies that could sneak in there and win Best Picture, and it'd be interesting to see once these year-end critics groups start to weigh in, and then the SAG Awards, the Golden Globes. We're just now getting into the heart of it.
Yes, all of that, and let's not forget Cats. Who knows? Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. Hollywood executives terrorizing assistants is such a cliche that YouTube offers supercuts of Entourage character Ari Gold firing them.
You're finished. Go. You're f***ing fired. You're fired. And in case your ears are f***ed, get the f*** out. Let me tell you something. You don't have to say anything. You know why? Because you pick up all your stuff because you're mother f***ing fired.
According to assistants who are now speaking out, that kind of abuse happens. And meanwhile, they're contending with rising costs, low wages, and increasingly bleak prospects for advancement. If you're on Hollywood Twitter, you may have seen assistant horror stories shared in recent weeks with the hashtag PayUpHollywood. The creator of that hashtag is Liz Alper. Her days as an assistant are behind her. She's now a TV writer who's worked on shows including Chicago Fire and The Rookie. But she hasn't forgotten what her life used to be like, and she's hoping future generations won't have to endure what she did. When Alper came to the studio recently, she was accompanied by Joelle, who's still working as an assistant and asked us not to use her last name for fear of retaliation. Alper said the creation of her hashtag was inspired in part by an episode of the Script Notes podcast hosted by writers John August and Craig Mason.
So John August had been asking for different stories from assistants about workplace abuses, low pay, what assistants were facing in this day and age. And this has been a topic that I've been passionate about for years. As someone who's mixed race, who came from not the wealthiest background, it was something that I've been noticing in the last 10 years where that there seems to be a paywall enacted around Hollywood that is keeping out diverse candidates who might come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds who can't afford to work these assistant jobs. So yeah. This was something that when John and Craig decided to do a series of episodes on it, I went to Twitter just explaining what my experience had been and, you know, trying to empower the assistants to share what they'd been going through.
You had a hashtag.
I had a hashtag because I'm
have,
very
currently hashtag, not past tense hashtag.
Yes, I do have a hashtag. I'm a millennial in that way, but it's hashtag pay up Hollywood. And what that did was organize these stories into one cohesive thread. And I keep looking at Joelle because she's been someone that I've been talking to for months about the things that assistants have been facing.
So Joelle, you are now an assistant.
I am currently an assistant, and I've been assisting for going on 15 years now. You know, it was this pay your dues mentality that this was supposed to be a job that you're only doing for a couple of years. And that was kind of why you sustained the low wages and the horrible working conditions in some cases. But again, there are some of us that now have been doing it for a long time, and my rate has only marginally improved in the past 10 years, regardless of experience.
So Liz, how long were you an assistant before you moved on?
So I was an assistant for about 8 years, and I'm now a professional television writer. I've been working as a television writer for the last 5 years. I was still an assistant longer than I've been a working TV writer. And currently I was elected to the WGA board of directors. And one of the points that I kept campaigning on is making sure that we don't let people fall through the cracks. And that extends to the people who aren't in the WGA. That's assistants everywhere. That's not just the writer assistants and the script coordinators, but the agency assistants and the network assistants and anyone who has worked as support staff, because this is a problem that everyone is facing. It is industry-wide.
And it's the same situation, right?
Yeah.
No overtime, crazy hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I imagine, maybe, well, you can, like having to say no. I mean,
And I think especially when you're starting out in this business, you're not empowered to say no because you just feel like this is what you're supposed to do. And hopefully by paying your dues at the end of it, it will lead to a staff writer job or a better position. So that's tough. The writers' assistants and script coordinators did unionize a couple years ago. We joined IATSE 871. And
this is a stage and theater, IA.
Yes, yeah. Yes. You know, and that has certainly helped that group. We're nowhere where we want to be in terms of wages and benefits, but that only extends to writers' assistants and script coordinators. There's a whole other slew of assistants, showrunners' assistants, PAs, who are the most vulnerable.
Production assistants on sets.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. That still are getting taken advantage of.
Joelle, I'm sure you've experienced this in the past, not at your current position, but in past ones where when I was a writer's assistant on House, it was my first writer's assistant job. Everyone was very nice. All of the writers were very nice. But there was a binder on my desk that I don't think anyone had realized was there. And it was a 5-inch binder that was packed to the brim. And I opened it up and it was just filled with resumes for the job that I had just received for the writer's assistant job.
It was a warning.
It was a warning. Yeah. An unintentional one because these were very nice people. But the saying of there is always going to be someone to take your job, that was solidified in this binder. For me, there were instances where I was paying for things out of pocket and not telling anyone having to do that.
What?
Oh, so we had a lunch fund where writers would put in money and I would use that to buy lunch every day.
For the group, yeah.
Yeah, for the room. Sometimes some writers would run low. And one writer who hadn't paid in a while was suddenly fired off the show. And he was 100 in the hole. And I was so embarrassed to tell anyone that I hadn't collected the money before that he left that I took $100 out of my own pocket and I put it into the lunch fund to cover it because I felt I had screwed up. So it was stuff like that where if I was in a hard position, it wasn't that the showrunner wasn't nice. I love David Shore and I ended up working for him for 3 years. But it was just the idea that if I make someone's life a little harder, maybe they'll go to one of these 1,000 resumes in this binder and hire them. And I've lost my shot at one day becoming the writer I want to be.
Yeah. Well, so just staying with that for a second, I mean, what's the right way? I mean, is it just that these guys should be decent and pay the freaking lunch fund? Or is it, putting it on you, but is the best we can do in this situation saying, you guys should be conscious of this and not short us on this fund? Or is there some other way to say, by God, pay up before I have to do it? Like, do you have ideas about how that should work?
Yeah, actually, I think what needs to happen is it's a case-by-case basis, but it starts when there's conversation. Anyone who employs an assistant should be going to the assistant and getting a very clear picture of what that assistant is going through. And that's been one of the big aspects of Pay Up Hollywood is that we're trying to educate.
It's consciousness raising.
Exactly.
But with that binder sitting on the desk with all the names of people who will do the job, is there still not fear? I mean, Joelle, you could...
I mean, of course there's fear. And that's why we've been in this position for as long as we've had. But, you know, the more that writers and showrunners and people that are in power get involved, eventually trickling to the studios, I think that fear will eventually go away and people will be more enabled to speak up.
For example, showrunners who are now in the know of what assistants are facing, they're the ones who are speaking up to business affairs saying, this is not acceptable. You do not come after my assistant for lunch overages or any sort of overages. You do not ask them to pay for anything out of their own pocket. If you have an issue, you come to me. And by standing up and saying to an assistant, you're not alone in this. If anyone tries to come after you, I am going to be there and I am going to say something on your behalf because they may think that it's okay to go after you because you're the lowest on the totem pole. But if every single writer in our writer's room is saying, you mess with them, you're messing with all of us, all of a sudden that assistant is empowered to be able to say, these are the abuses that I'm facing. These are the things that are going on. And it's tough because on the other hand, there are some assistants who are in positions where the showrunner or their direct boss is the person who is.
Yeah. I mean, I've covered this business for a while and dealt with people who are awful. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's always, there are always going to be good people and then there are always going to be god-awful, terrible people.
Yeah.
But I think what happens right now is that there are people in power rising up and saying, we're not just going to stand for our assistant, we are going to look at this as though this is a systematic change that needs to be enacted in order to, one, make sure that the next generation of Hollywood assistants aren't burnt out and broke by the time that it's time for them to take up the mantle, but also that we're ensuring that the future of Hollywood, we're not saying you have to come from a specific financial background in order to make it in this industry.
Coming up after a short break, Pay Up Hollywood hashtag creator Liz Alper shares some assistant horror stories she's read on Twitter. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to TV writer Liz Alper, creator of the hashtag Pay Up Hollywood, a move to get Hollywood assistants paid a living wage. She's joined by Joelle, who's currently a script coordinator on a network TV show, but who doesn't want us to use her last name. Pay Up Hollywood has conducted a recent survey of assistants and support staff, and at a recent town hall, Alper shared some of what emerged from more than 1,000 responses. Almost 63% of assistants who took the survey said they made less than $50,000 a year. More than 67% said they had to take on second jobs outside the entertainment industry to supplement their income. Nearly half of the assistants who responded said they were receiving financial help from their parents. It used to be, you know, you could be, I mean, if you look at some of the biggest names in this industry, Jeffrey Katzenberg, David Geffen, Barry Diller, these people didn't go to college at all. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, to be an assistant, I think it's assumed that you're going to have a college degree at least, right?
I think it's required.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely required to have a college degree. So there are assistants who are coming in already saddled with upwards of $40,000 to $50,000 in student loan debt. And then you add on the expenses that come with simply having that job. If you're a writer's assistant, you have to know what's on television. So you have to have a cable subscription mm-hmm. and you have to have the streaming subscriptions. If you are working at an agency, you have to dress the
part. Yeah, mm-hmm.
yeah, exactly. So you might be spending upwards of $200 a month out of your base salary.
Well, I would consider that conservative based on what
that
yeah,
very incredibly costs. Incredibly yeah. conservative because it has to be.
And speaking to that, I mean, I will say too, I think that there's, aside from the student loan debt, I'm incredibly lucky. I went to a state school, so I didn't have student loans. But I do think that that is part of the reason that I've been able to work for almost 15 years as an assistant. If I had that extra expense on top of everything else, there's no way I would have been able to afford it. As it is, the other thing is during hiatus on TV shows, I'm not getting an income, you know, anything that I would get from unemployment or money that I'd saved, that's just going to just rent, which is, you know, $1,400 a month. Everything else is going on my credit card. Since I've been working in this business, I've consistently had probably $10,000 worth of credit card debt. Oof. And that seems to be the norm amongst people that I've
that
talked to.
That is like money cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, with the interest rates that they charge.
But that's, it you really know, is, in order yeah. to get the clothes that you need or go to the dinners that the writers are going to, that's the burden that you take on.
Yeah. And we're also, I mean, we're lucky because we also don't have family members that we need to take care of financially.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of candidates who would be wonderful writers, amazing network execs, and they can't even get their foot in the door because their financial obligations are to their family.
I'm a parent now. And yeah. I mean, you know, I have a toddler, and which is amazing. But one big fear of my husband and I when we decided to have a family was, how are we going to do this with the long hours, with, you know, the minimal paycheck? I'm able to do it because I do have, you know, a husband. But even still, I talk to so many parents that want to break into the business and want to start as an assistant. And, you know, I'm fortunate that I have very understanding showrunners that are lenient with my schedule. Not a lot of them are. And so even those people that, you know, parents that want to break into the business, there's not a lot of opportunity for them.
So I assume that your hashtag and the whole effort between Craig Mazin and John August, and all credit to them for
yes.
caring.
Yes, very much
and
so.
Doing more than just sitting there and saying, this is terrible. You've gotten flooded with stories, I assume. And I don't know whether you, Joelle, have a particular story that's like, this is in a nutshell how awful. I mean, all of what we've been talking about is not good, but is yeah. you know, some, what are the horror stories that really stick with you guys?
I mean, I think, you know, after a while, all this stuff starts to take a real emotional toll. There's so many levels of abuse, too, of being promised certain jobs and working for free. And I mean, I think part of this conversation also started with someone had asked about, have assistants had things thrown at them?
Right.
And
I'll just say the name Scott Rudin. And
yeah. And, you know, I have had a stapler thrown at me. I've had markers thrown at me. I had my own high heel taken off at a party and thrown for me to fetch.
Not so, in fun, but in creepiness?
No. In a very, angry. It was not fun for me, I will say that.
Why would someone do that?
That goes to the culture of that there is a reminder of you are not treated equal as the rest of us here.
Yeah, you're not a person.
You're not a person. There are a million of you lining up to take your job. You don't deserve the respect. You don't deserve the pay. And I think that that is really what people are rallying against right now.
Do you have one for us that, that sticks with you? Not necessarily your own story or your own story, depending.
No, there are so many. I mean, this has been a very difficult few weeks because we've had thousands of stories submitted, and there are some great ones. There are some real champion bosses out there. And a lot of them, I mean, when you said stapler in my head, that I kind of went, yeah, that's the number one item that apparently gets thrown at assistants.
We need somebody to design like foam staplers.
Yes. Yes.
Or just not throw them.
That is absolutely the better, idea.
Yeah. It was really disheartening because there was one day where I had roughly 50 stories and they were all from different parts of the industry. And they were like, yeah, I've had a stapler thrown at me. I've had a chair thrown at me. I made them angry. And it just kind of showed that there is this abusive nature that is prevalent, that's been forgiven because it's part of the work culture. It's part of paying your dues. But I think the stories that stuck with me the most were the ones that assistants would discuss being pressured to not put down overtime. And the stories that where it was the HR departments telling the assistants, well, why don't you have parents that can help you out financially? Well, don't you know that this is how it works in this industry? Do you really want this job if you're not going to take it for $450 a week? Like, do you really want to be here? It broke my heart because it's people who are preying on the most hopeful people in this industry and using that hope and that desire to do well against them, to manipulate them and undercut their wages. And so it's a culture of fear that's kept people in low paying wages who made them feel as though they're frozen and that they can't do anything. And that's what we want to change. That's what Deirdre, who's my Pay Up Hollywood cohort, she and I have been desperate to get people to understand that this cannot be the way that we conduct business in Hollywood any longer if we want to ensure that this industry will last beyond us. This is a cannibalistic way of treating people because you are running assistants and you are running people into the ground and you are ensuring that we will not have a next generation of Hollywood execs who did not already come from previously wealthy backgrounds.
I mean, one of the questions in my mind is why now? And I would think in part, maybe the Time's Up movement inspired some of the anger. Like, why are we? Because Time's Up starts out with egregious sexual abuse, like Harvey Weinstein, allegedly, and ends up with abuse.
Yeah.
I certainly think that that's the case. You know, I think once you see people speaking up about other issues, it enables you to start speaking up and share your own stories. It certainly has been the case for me personally.
And also, I think the internet gives and takes away because one of the reasons that assistants are so squeezed right now, I would think, and there's no movement, is because the industry itself is going through this very difficult transition. You know, a lot of the opportunity. And I mean, if you're Ryan Murphy or Shonda Rhimes, the opportunity is absolutely great. But if you're not, everybody else in the middle and lower ranks is like squeezed. So yeah, the assistants therefore get squeezed. Yeah. But the internet, I would think, also is a reason why you guys find each other.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the ability to foster a community without actually having met in person, but still find the people who are going through the same things that you're going through and hearing that, oh, I'm not crazy. This didn't just happen to me.
I feel like something big is starting here.
I think so.
Yes. Writer and former assistant Liz Alper is the creator of the hashtag PayUpHollywood. And Joelle is now a script coordinator on a network TV show. Thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.